I guess the private equity job offer came through, and she's going to move on.
David, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about the presidential vote totals in the primaries. One is the significant numbers of uncommitted votes in Minnesota and a few other states on the Democratic side, but also the turnout. It seems to me, I haven't looked at all the states yet, but it seems to me that there was far more turnout among Republicans than there was among Democrats in several major states. Does that suggest, obviously, the question of enthusiasm among the both Republicans and Democrats as we go through this this primary season?
I don't think so. I mean, there really was no race on the Democratic side. Joe Biden's an incumbent. You had token opposition, you know, people like Dean Phillips who were running. But that race has largely been over. It's kind of true that the Republican race has largely been over. But you had two major candidates between Trump and Nikki Haley. And so I think there was more interest in turning out. And of course, Nikki Haley received she won in Vermont and she received significant vote totals in other states. The enthusiasm may have been coming from the Nikki Haley side of the spectrum to get out and try to vote. But of course, you know, Trump has kind of been the de facto nominee and now probably the real nominee if Nikki Haley indeed suspends her campaign today for a long time. And so this, even though I think voters haven't quite tuned in yet and they don't really know yet that there's going to be a rematch of 2020 and whether that's something they want or not, it's clearly going to happen. But I wouldn't read a whole lot into the turnout statistics at this point.
And the uncommitted?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a phenomenon. I mean, these particular uncommitted campaigns in Minnesota and North Carolina and Massachusetts really sprouted up in a week in the wake of the Michigan uncommitted vote, which had a little bit of money and a little bit of a campaign for several weeks. The fact that 19% of the vote in Minnesota is going uncommitted shows that for those, you know, that small section of the electorate that is showing up in these primaries on the Democratic side, a non-trivial amount of those people are really agitated by the war in Gaza and want to see the administration change course on what they're calling for. The administration has slightly shifted its rhetoric around a ceasefire, but really is asking for the same temporary pause in fighting and return of hostages they've always asked for. And so clearly there's continued discontent among a slice of the electorate, which could be, you know, have a major impact in November if they don't see results.
Finally, we have less than a minute, David, but the significance of one of the richest men in the world, if not the richest, Elon Musk, meeting with Biden at Mar-a-Lago this weekend could pay off what? All of his campaign debts, has referred to the Biden administration's immigration policies as amounting to treason. No, he met with Trump. Sorry.
Yes. It obviously the factor there would be if he writes a big check, Elon, he certainly has gotten more and more interested in politics. He tried to influence the DA's race in Austin, Texas, where he lives, and failed spectacularly yesterday. Mr. Garza, the DA, progressive reform DA, won pretty convincingly in Austin. So he was unsuccessful in that foray. However, if he writes, you know, a $30 million, $50 million check to Donald Trump, obviously there would be significant repercussions from that.
David Day, I want to thank you for being with us. Executive editor of the American Prospect will link to all of your coverage of Super Tuesday. When we come back, as Donald Trump solidifies his lead, Super Tuesday, Supreme Court ruled Monday he can't be barred from the ballot under the Insurrection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Stay with us. Colorado by Milky Chance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday states don't have the authority to remove Donald Trump from the ballot under the Insurrection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was written to prevent Civil War Confederates from returning to government. In the majority opinion, justices wrote, quote, states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency, end quote. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment has never been used against a presidential candidate. It's only been deployed 8 times since 1860s. Trump responded to the ruling by thanking the Supreme Court.
I want to start by thanking the Supreme Court for its unanimous decision today. It was a very important decision. We're very well crafted, and I think it will go a long way toward bringing our country together, which our country needs. Essentially, you cannot take somebody out of a race because an opponent would like to have it that way.
The court's 3 liberal justices issued a concurring opinion warning the majority ruling attempts to insulate all alleged insurrectionists from future challenges to their holding federal office. For more, we're joined by Mark Joseph Stern, Slate senior writer covering courts and law, where his latest piece is headlined, "The Supreme Court's Unanimous Trump Ballot Ruling is Actually a 5-4 Disaster." He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark. Why is it a disaster?
Thank you so much for having me on.
Your take on this is different from many others.
So, you know, this is a decision that's unanimous in name only. If you look at the separate opinions in the case, you can see easily that the court actually split 5-4 on one of the biggest questions here, which is how can the insurrection clause actually be enforced against candidates who have rebelled against the United States government? 5 conservative justices, as it happens, all 5 men on the court, reached out and grasped at this bigger question and decided that only Congress and Congress alone can enforce Section 3 against federal candidates, against senators, congressmen, the president, any other federal office holder, and that absent specific congressional legislation enforcing this clause, it just can't be done. The 4 women on the court did not agree with that proposition, and they faulted the majority for going way too far in deciding this case. Each of them pointed out this could have been done on far narrower grounds. The court could have unanimously decided that states can't unilaterally take candidates off the ballot under the insurrection clause, under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but instead the majority couldn't help itself and went further. And as the 3 liberals pointed out in their separate opinion, what the majority has effectively done is insulate all oath-breaking insurrectionists, in their words, from ever being disqualified from the ballot in the future.
And how would you characterize the differences between the 3 liberal women justices on the court and Justice Amy Coney Barrett?
So, you know, the 3 liberal justices were pretty outraged by what the majority did and included some rather indignant rhetoric, I think entirely appropriate, certainly in line with the court's usual operations. Just, again, faulting the majority for reaching out, for going way over the line and answering a question that did not need to be answered. And by the way, also doing so in quite an ambiguous way. It leaves a lot of questions open for the future that the court probably should have resolved if it was going to go this far. So their opinion really read like a dissent. In fact, I happened to sort of look under the hood of this file. I looked at the metadata. The Supreme Court forgot to scrub the metadata. There is an indication that this was originally styled as a dissenting opinion. And at some point, very late in the process, it was changed to a concurrence. Still reads like a dissent. Justice Amy Coney Barrett agreed with the liberals that the majority went too far, but she decided to engage in some tone policing. She said, you know, there's stridency in the liberal opinion. This is a time to turn the national temperature down, not up. So I'm not going to join them and I'm not going to elaborate any further on my own disagreements because I don't want to inflame the nation any more than it already is in a presidential election year. So really a difference in style, not substance.
And in terms of the implications of this decision for those anti-Trump Americans who are looking for the legal system, either through this kind of a challenge or through the criminal cases against Donald Trump to be able to prevent him from actually running or winning a term as president. What's your sense about that?
So I tend to agree with the three liberal justices that what the majority did here was effectively foreclose any avenue of disqualification for Donald Trump or any other person who engaged in January 6th and then runs for federal office or seeks an appointment to federal office. I think that pathway is now closed. And the reason why is because I don't think anyone seriously thinks that Congress is going to now enact some kind of special detailed legislation that creates rules and procedures and standards for disqualifying Donald Trump and other insurrectionists from the ballot. Jamie Raskin, a Democratic congressman from Maryland, is working on it. There's some movement, but no one thinks it's going to clear 60 votes in the Senate. Turning to the criminal justice system, again, it's frankly unclear whether the majority thinks that Donald Trump can even be disqualified by the courts, even if he's found to have engaged in insurrection. So there's this statute that actually dates back to the 1860s that says if you are criminally convicted of an insurrection, then you are disqualified from office. That seems like it might meet the majority standard, but the majority does not say whether it actually cuts the mustard and leaves an open question, not one that's particularly relevant now, because for better or worse, Special Counsel Jack Smith did not prosecute Donald Trump under that statute for engaging in insurrection. Jack Smith made the conscious effort not to pursue that path. And so, again, I just do not see how Trump could possibly be disqualified from this or any future election.
Mark Joseph Stern, I don't know if you can answer this because it doesn't involve this particular decision, but on the issue of court's rulings and him having to pay up, something like $600 million now from dealing with the sexual assault libel case of E. Jean Carroll, over $80 million, over $450 million in that civil case brought by the Attorney General Letitia James. What's to stop Trump from going to get foreign money like his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, did, getting $2 billion from the Saudi sovereign fund, going to MBS or whoever, Mohammed bin Salman, to say he needs money?
So I think the answer is the New York court system has shown more integrity in prosecuting and dealing with Trump's various civil and criminal charges than the federal system. We have seen New York judges trying really hard to uphold and apply the law. And there are restrictions in New York on who can assist a defendant in helping to post bond. But they aren't restrictions that often come into play. You know, this law under which Trump was charged civilly that he now owes $450 million under, it's not frequently used. We're sort of in uncharted waters here. And so I don't want to say definitively whether the courts would allow him to post bond with foreign money. What I will say is that Trump has a very sprawling financial network that he has repeatedly used to try to launder money, including foreign money, and sort of cleanse the dirtiness of it and then use it for his own ends. And I could very much see him doing that here. And I just have to say, I think it's very ironic that as Republicans on the Hill are scrambling to try to accuse President Biden of having some kind of foreign connection to his money, that he's going through his son to obtain dirty money from Ukraine, all of these unproved allegations. We know that Donald Trump's own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as you noted, is obtaining dirty foreign money. And there is a very real possibility that he could help to funnel some of that money up to his father to help him get out of legal trouble. Father-in-law, thank you, to get out of legal trouble. And we may never actually know if it happens.
And of course, President Trump also just met with the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer at Slate, covering courts and the law. We'll link to your latest piece. The Supreme Court's unanimous Trump ballot ruling is actually a 5-4 disaster. Coming up, we go to Cairo to speak with the Palestinian novelist and activist Susan Abu Hawa. She was just in Gaza. Stay with us. Palestine. Abba Methuthi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A UN convoy of food trucks trying to bring 200 tons of food into northern Gaza was turned back by the Israeli military today. A convoy of 14 trucks waited for 3 hours at the Wadi Gaza checkpoint in central Gaza before it was turned away by the Israeli military and later stopped by a large crowd of desperate people who, quote, looted the food, according to the World Food Program. This comes as Israeli forces have repeatedly opened fire on Palestinians seeking to get aid in northern Gaza, killing at least 119 people in the most deadly attack February 29th. Hunger has reached catastrophic levels in Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry said today the death toll from malnutrition and dehydration has risen to 18, adding, quote, the famine's deepening and will claim thousands of lives if the aggression is not halted and humanitarian and medical aid is not immediately brought in, unquote. Children, pregnant women, those with chronic illnesses are most vulnerable. Meanwhile, the Israeli bombardment continues with shelling and airstrikes today in cities across the Gaza Strip, including in Rafah, Khan Yunis, Deir al-Abah, and elsewhere. At least 30,700 Palestinians have been killed, over 72,000 wounded in Gaza over the past 5 months. Nearly the entire population has been displaced from their homes. For more, we go to Cairo, Egypt, where we're joined by Susan Abu Hawa, a Palestinian novelist, poet, and activist, author of several books, best known for her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin, an international bestseller translated into 32 languages, considered a classic in Palestinian literature. She's the founder and co-director of Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's organization, and the executive director of Palestine Rights Literature Festival. She just returned from Gaza after spending 2 weeks there, as now in Cairo. Susan, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what you saw. You have written, some are eating stray cats and dogs, which are themselves starving and sometimes feeding on human remains that litter streets where Israeli snipers pick off people who dare to venture within the sight of their scopes. The old and weak have already died of hunger and thirst. Describe your trip.
So that part of the essay is in the northern region where nobody really is allowed to go. Trying to venture into the north is a suicide mission. There are tanks and snipers positioned, and anyone trying to get there is basically killed. As you just mentioned, aid trucks are not getting in either. They are intentionally stopped, and it's an intentional starvation, basically. I was primarily in the south, in Rafah. I was able to go to Khan Yunis and to Nusayrat and a few other places in the middle region, but that became increasingly more dangerous. I want to say that the reality on the ground is infinitely worse than the worst videos and photos that we're seeing in the West. There is a you know, beyond people being buried alive en masse in their homes, their bodies being shredded to pieces, these kinds of videos and images that people are seeing. Beyond that, there is this daily massive degradation of life. It is a total denigration of a whole society that was once high functioning and proud and has basically been reduced to the most primal of ambitions. You know, being able to get enough water for the day or flour to bake bread. And this is even in Rafah. And the people in Rafah will tell you that they feel privileged because they're not starving to death while their families in the north, the ones that they can reach, because Israel has basically cut off, 99% of communication. What remains are basically communications by people who have, you know, set up some ingenious ways to keep internet in the north. But most people in the north have no idea what's happening. As a matter of fact, at one point, I'm sure you all know Bisan Ode, who is on Facebook. She explained to me, she often goes up to the border between Khan Yunis and the middle area in the north where you can't go beyond. And she explained to me that an aid truck that sort of pushed its way through but was eventually fired on, had people came up and ran up thinking that the war was over and people were returning to the north. So most people in the north are in total darkness and hunger and really have no way of communicating, no way of figuring out where to get food. And what we're hearing on the ground is surreal. I mean, it's dystopic. What I witnessed personally in Rafah and in some of the middle areas is incomprehensible. And I will call it a Holocaust, and I don't use that word lightly, but it is absolutely that.
Susan,
the stories I heard from people are... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, Susan, I wanted to ask you, you write in your article, at some point the indignity of filth is unescapable. At some point, you just wait for death, even as you wait for a ceasefire. But people don't know what they will do after a ceasefire. Could you talk about that? Even if there is a ceasefire, the level of destruction that the people face now in terms of being able to rebuild their country.
I mean, that's how much people have been reduced. I mean, the ceiling of their hope at this point is for the bombs to stop. And, you know, everybody wants to go back. They talk about pitching a tent on their homes and figuring things out. But a lot of people are trying to leave. There is a brain drain, basically. Those who can afford it, those who can raise the money, those who are able to get jobs elsewhere, who have professional skills, are trying to leave. They have children. All the schools have been destroyed. College students have nowhere to go. What's happening to people isn't just this death and dismemberment and hunger. It's a total denigration of their personhood, of their whole society. There are no universities left. Israel intentionally bombed schools and blew them up, presumably to ensure that rebuilding could not take place, that reestablishing a society cannot take place without the infrastructure of education, of healthcare, and basically foundational structures for buildings.
Susan, I wanted to follow up on what you said about a Holocaust, and you also use the term genocide. And you say genocide isn't just mass murder. It's intentional erasure. Can you take that from there?
Exactly. I mean, one of the, like I said, one of the things that Israel has been keen to do in Gaza is to erase remnants of people's lives. So you have, on an individual level, homes complete with memories and photos and all the things of living. And I'm sure you know Palestinians typically live in multi-generational homes. We're not a mobile society. And so these homes have several generations of the same family completely wiped out. On a societal level, you have Israel has targeted places of worship, mosques, ancient churches, ancient mosques. They've targeted the museums, cultural centers, any place that libraries, any place that has records of people's lives, has remnants and traces of their roots in the land, have been intentionally wiped away. It's really frustrating for us to read Western media talk about, you know, Israel's targeting Hamas and whatnot. They're not. This is always, and when you're on the ground, you understand this has always been about displacing Palestinians, taking their place, and wiping them off the map. That has been Israel's stated goal. I mean, even in this instance and before, in 1948, it has always been their aim to destroy us, remove us, kill us, and take our place. And that's what's happening now in Gaza. It's what happened in 1948, in 1967. And every new Nakba, every new escalation is greater than the one before. And here we now arrive at a moment of genocide and Holocaust, because the world has allowed Israel to act with such barbarity, with impunity.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned what the world's reaction. More people have died in Gaza in less than 5 months than have civilians that have died in Ukraine in over 2 years in the war in Ukraine. And Ukraine is 40 times the population of Gaza. I'm wondering your sense of the failure of the, especially of the Western nations of Europe and the United States to act.
The Western world has lost any semblance of moral authority, if they ever had any. Or, you know, I think that maybe there was an illusion of moral authority previously. But I think, you know, what we have always known is that we are dealing with genocidal colonizers. But I think that is more apparent to the rest of the world at this hour. And I think what's also happening is that Americans are coming to understand increasingly, though not nearly enough, that they're being
lied to. And we're going to take up that issue in part two of our discussion, which we'll post at democracynow.org. Susan Abahawa, Palestinian novelist. Thanks so much.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano, every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancor fanciulli e ogni sera su quel prato.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.